Hey bosses, before we kick off this week's episode, I want to take a minute to tell you about Indeed.com. Indeed is the number one job site in the world, and now they have a new way of matching you with quality candidates instantly. Indeed is the only job site that can now move as fast as you do. I'll tell you more about the new instant match feature at the break, but if you want to learn more now, head over to Indeed.com/iLab. That's Indeed.com/ILAB. Now, on to the show.
Welcome to the Invest Like a Boss podcast.
I'm Sam Marks.
And I'm Johnny FD. We're self-made entrepreneurs who invest our own money and use modern technology to invest like a boss.
Join us each week for exclusive interviews with our network of modern investors, business owners, and multimillionaires to discover new ways to invest our hard-earned cash.
Hey, bosses. Welcome back. This is episode 164. This is Sam, and I am tuning in from the rebel state of South Carolina. I'm joined by Derek. Big D, welcome to the show.
Hey, what's up, Sam? I'm still stuck in LA. We're on total lockdown. And I thought for the first time ever, we were going to be in the same state because you had mentioned coming to California, but I guess that wasn't the case.
Well, the snow conditions didn't materialize as well as I had hoped. I had a trip planned to Big Bear, Mammoth. And then I was going to go out to Tahoe because I got some early snow this year, but then it seems like everything's melted. So skipping that trip, and I'm just going to fly out to Denver in 2 weeks and get up into higher altitude and hopefully get some early skiing in.
Probably a good plan. California is not the hottest place to be right now, or coldest, I guess, in your case.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't make sense to travel for travel's sake right now. So trying to keep it low key. But next time, Derek, next time. Or if you ever want to come to the Rebel State, got lots to do here all times of the year. Beautiful place. You'll love it.
I like the pitch. Speaking of pitches, last week we talked about the Airbnb IPO, another huge IPO coming up. Actually, today, I just checked as we're recording this, and it's not available yet. They said sometime midday it might start trading, but we're talking about DoorDash.
DoorDash. It's funny. We recorded this episode 3 days ago. You and I are doing the commentary the day of the IPO. We'll get this episode out probably 3 days after the IPO. So we'll have some good frames of reference going into the IPO, the day of the IPO, and after the IPO. And Derek, you and I both have some experience in the industry. We're on this episode, we're going to have on Mike Mergio, who joined us in episode 65 when the Tesla versus Ford episode, when we talked about Tesla becoming a 10-bagger investment in the future, which it now has exactly become a 10-bagger investment since episode 65. We're actually going to have it on his brother, Joe Mergio, who runs a company called Deliver Logic. We're going to talk a little bit about that company, but they basically provide software for food delivery operators, similar to DoorDash, not DoorDash exactly, but similar and smaller competitors nationwide. So very interesting perspective they're going to have. But Derek, you've actually done some side hustles with DoorDash. Tell us a little bit about that.
I have indeed. So DoorDash bought a smaller, more kind of niche delivery service called Caviar, which I was a part of until about 6 months ago. So they converted everybody to work for DoorDash as a quote dasher. Basically, it's those people that go and deliver your food. You know, it's not the most glamorous thing in the world, but I will tell you, it's super easy. I mean, I would never call it a difficult job at all, but you also got to balance the finances with it too. It's also probably one of the lowest paying gigs available as like a side hustle. You can get lucky with tips. And fortunately they do kind of give you a pretty good estimate of what you're going to get paid before you take an order. So for those of you that get, your food's late or it's really cold, no offense, but you're probably a bad tipper and someone's not taking your order. So, or the person that is taking it, it's gotten bounced around so many times that someone just finally settles on it and takes it and you're getting your cold hamburger and soggy fries.
Wow, there's a pro tip. So actually, if you are ordering on DoorDash or I'm assuming like Uber Eats, if you're ordering food, the drivers can actually see your tipping history.
You can see the tip on that current order. Not necessarily the previous ones, but that one that you're about to deliver.
Well, what if, but in Uber Eats, when I tip after the food's been delivered.
So
you want to add a tip.
I'm not sure about how Uber Eats works because I haven't done it, but beforehand on DoorDash, you can actually tip ahead.
Oh, I kind of like that model actually better because it sort of gives a way for them to prioritize your food instead of somebody else's order.
Exactly. I mean, if I see an order that's going to be $20 or an order that'll be $7, I'm taking the $20 one every time.
So how much do you get paid by DoorDash per order outside of the tip?
It's pretty awful, honestly, and which I think maybe why DoorDash could be a good investment, because the money that comes out of their pocket is very minimal. Most jobs would pay $3 to $4 per order out of DoorDash, and the rest is coming directly from a tip. So the tips are extremely important if you're a Dasher, whereas a DoorDash just has a base, you know, $3 fee, and they're probably making well more than that in their commissions from these restaurants.
I saw an article with some Dasher that said he was making $8,000 a month, but he was working 7 days a week, 12-hour days.
I could see that, but if you break it out hourly, it's not so hot.
You know, or Derek, you can build a software business. You can make a quarter an order automated while you sleep. What do you think about that? It's like selling sodas.
I mean, when you put it that way, it's not so awful. A quarter an order adds up if you're sleeping.
You got to spend 6 years building the software. Then you get an annuity for life. It's great.
So, exactly. So, Sam, you're actually invested in this company a little bit as well, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So we helped acquire this company in 2014. So Joe actually runs it, and Mike and I are shareholders in the company. We're going to talk about this company a little bit just to give the listeners some frame of reference and perspective on especially Joe's experience in the industry, because we've seen all these companies and all these new entrants emerge and really disrupt the industry. And it's been both good and bad for our business at different times. As you can imagine, Uber Eats and DoorDash coming into a market where some of our clients are operating, you would think is horrible. But actually, when Uber Eats and DoorDash go into a market, they make the entire pie of that market so much bigger, because they're bringing so many new customers into food delivery space and food ordering space. So it's been crazy. So we'll talk and hear Joe's perspective on that. But of course, the main focus of the episode is going to be the DoorDash IPO, the fundamentals of it. We're going to talk a little bit about the S1. We're going to talk about how to buy the DoorDash IPO stock on the secondary market, much like you guys discussed in the Airbnb episode. So I think it'll be fun. We got back-to-back IPO episodes, two super hot companies, Airbnb, and now we're covering DoorDash. Stay tuned for Derek and Mike's commentary. We're going to talk about what we're doing with DoorDash and even in the space, because I got another investment in the space we can talk about as well.
Oh, I can't wait to hear it. Let's hear from Mike and Joe Mergio. We're going to talk DoorDash IPO.
This week's Invest Like a Boss episode is sponsored by Indeed.com. Indeed is the number one job site in the world. They reach 73% of U.S. job seekers, according to Comscore. So not only can Indeed find you a quality candidate, but now they can do it even faster with their new Instant Match feature. They'll now provide you with a short list of qualified candidate resumes the moment you post your job, making Indeed the only job site that can move as fast as you do. And right now, Indeed is offering our listeners a free $75 credit to boost your job post. This is their best offer anywhere. Claim your credit now at Indeed.com/iLab. That's Indeed.com/ILAB. Offer valid through December 31st, 2020. Terms and conditions apply.
Mike, Joe, welcome to the show.
Hello, hey. Sam. Good morning. Hey, Sam. Thanks for having us.
Mike, we've had you on previously, and we had to bring you back on because you famously called the 10x Tesla prediction, which I now have 10x in my account. Thank you very much. So I don't know if we're going to have predictions on this episode, but let's see where it goes. We got DoorDash
going public.
Yeah, that's a big hurdle. All right. Did you end up investing in Ford at that time?
Absolutely.
Ford's slipping still. Too bad. Good company. Too bad. Tesla's the new stallion in town. So now we got a really hot and highly anticipated IPO coming up, DoorDash. We're a couple days before the IPO. IPO is supposed to be on Tuesday, the 8th. So this episode will probably get out, I think, maybe a few days after. We also have Airbnbs going this week too. So it's going to be
very interesting week, to say the least. But we wanted to kind of do a dedicated episode on DoorDash. And actually, I think what's as important and as interesting is just the food delivery market, because Joe, Mike, you've been involved in it for a while now, but Joe, especially being on the ground for as many years as he has, both in food delivery and even before that, just on the restaurant side of things, that it's just the changes over the last decade have been insane, as in so many industries. So I thought we'd use this to cover kind of the broad changes that have taken place and transpired over the last decade, especially from Joe's experience. And then we'll jump into the DoorDash IPO and figure out what's what, how good is it, and how big is it going to be, and are we all going to invest? So, Joe, I think it'd be awesome to hear from you initially just a little bit about DeliverLogic. We've never talked about that company on this on Invest Like a Boss before, but it's a really interesting company. It's also much different in certain ways than some of these big delivery companies like Grubhub, DoorDash, Uber Eats that we'll probably touch on. But maybe to start the episode, you could give just a little bit of background about what DeliverLogic actually does and how that compares to someone like DoorDash, just as a frame of reference for the listeners.
Sure. So DeliverLogic is a SaaS business. It was founded in 2008. And really, the software provides the ability for business owners to start their own local delivery services. And it really just, it powers everything from, capturing orders and communicating with the restaurant and drivers. So taking the consumer from the website, getting their order, communicating that order to the restaurant through the technology, then once the food is ready, getting that food to a driver using the driver app, and then going all the way into back-end management and executing the payments to the drivers and the restaurants and giving the business owner the ability to manage their financials, see consumer feedback, and even, automated marketing and a lot of other ancillary services to help them grow their business. So the biggest difference between, let's say, DeliverLogic and one of the three that you mentioned, which Uber, Grubhub, DoorDash, would be that we are purely focused on the technology side. And then our clients are really the ones that are out there competing with those large businesses to capture orders and get the food to the consumers.
Right. So DeliverLogic, sort of a comprehensive web or tech solution for smaller independent food delivery companies. So it could be like Joe's Tampa Delivery, and they might only be operating in one or two markets compared to, say, DoorDash would be operating, nationally and probably even internationally in the future. So DeliverLogic's business model is just a fee per order for the clients that are using the software, correct?
That's correct. And I think it's the interesting part of it is we do have clients that are located in one location, right? Like you said, let's say Joe's Delivery in Tampa, or we could have, Sam's Delivery, and that could be in multiple states or even multiple countries. Because right now we're operational in about 42 states. 23 countries, and that includes I think we're up to somewhere around 15 different languages and dialects right now on the platform.
So we got this company in 2014. Joe started running the business, and the changes in the last 6 years have been pretty crazy. It's been an emotional ride, to say the least, through a lot of different ups and down cycles. But I think the story is pretty interesting. So 2014, DoorDash was just, it was like eight people in a converted house. So they're just getting off the ground. Uber Eats and Grubhub, like, I don't even remember those companies back then, but can you just replay the story in your mind from kind of inception of the business when we actually took over the business? Because it was already an operating business when we took it over. And then some of these new entrants, like, and their impact on the industry and also on DeliverLogic's business, and then we can roll that into sort of COVID-19, which has been a whole nother story. But yeah, it'd be just good to hear kind of the replay from your perspective.
Yeah, so I mean, it's been pretty interesting, to say the least. But I mean, when we took over, you know, there were some large delivery service companies out there that had their own technology, but nothing near the size and scale of the Ubers and DoorDashes. What's really interesting, and I know we're going to kind of talk about Grubhub a little later, but, you know, Grubhub originally was essentially a marketing aggregator for restaurant delivery listings. So really they would list the restaurants. They did not execute their own deliveries. Companies like our clients, they executed the deliveries. So we were working with Grubhub pretty closely and handling their deliveries. So they would capture the order. They would send the order to us through the technology. It would then get routed out to our clients who would execute the deliveries. And that's really, you know, a big piece of why I think where Grubhub is in comparison to DoorDash and Uber. And at that time, the biggest thing with restaurant delivery service that I think has changed now, and other than technology advancing, which is always going to happen as more competitors and more money enters into a market. But on the actual business side, the biggest difference was almost everyone had partnerships with the restaurants where they were receiving commissions. So it was, and it was a huge debate all the time at restaurant delivery conferences, which was, do you list non-partners or do you not list non-partners? And of course, the advantage to having the partner is there's more revenue, number one. And number two, the logistics are much easier because if you have that connection to them where they agree to take the order, there are just easier ways to get them the order. Where if not, then it's kind of like you're calling it in as a customer and going to pick it up, and that creates an inefficiency and an extra cost. So really, with DoorDash, it was very interesting because they came into the market. They had a lot of focus on the technology and acquiring consumers through marketing, and then they just basically said for inventory, we're just going to list everyone. And I think their motto was like giving all restaurants the ability to have delivery when in actuality, they were just saying like, we believe that if we have the most inventory, regardless of, you know, if we have to put an extra cost on the consumer because we're not creating we're not getting a commission from that restaurant, people will still shop with us because they like different choices. And I think they were right. I mean, they kind of proved the argument, which was, you know, do you work with non-partners or not? They just said, yes, we do. We work with everyone. And then eventually, I believe what happened with them was they were driving so much business to these restaurants with so much inefficiency that the restaurants just said, fine, like, we'll be your partner, right? Like, so, and then they started to get more efficiencies. And they had a ton of consumers, and they had really good technology, and I think that put them in a great position.
So they really took a land grab approach, and if I understand it correctly, what they did where other people didn't is a lot of the other players in the industry, including a lot of DeliverLogic clients, would go out and actually try to make the partnerships and get the business and the commission relationship before listing that restaurant on their marketplace or on their platform. But what DoorDash did, it was like, okay, what's preventing us from listing, say, McDonald's? We don't have a relationship right with them, but what's preventing us? Because all we have to do is put them on and put their menu on our site, and someone makes an order, even though we can't send that order directly to McDonald's, we'll just have someone roll up there and order that Happy Meal, and then we'll deliver it. And we won't get a commission initially off of that order, but once we start sending them enough business and we can demonstrate that, then we can go back and get a great deal. In the meantime, we're acquiring customers because we have all the inventory. We're not waiting for relationships to form. We're just listing them and immediately placing orders. And we'll just do the orders manually like anyone else that makes an order would do it. Is that correct with their strategy?
That is correct. And the interesting part to that is our clients were big on, you can't charge the consumer extra to do this. Right. And a lot of people in the industry were on that. So they were saying, we're collecting anywhere from 20 to 30% from the restaurant. And then we're just charging the consumer a small delivery fee, which averaged about $4.25, $4.50, and still does, really. And DoorDash just said, no, we're just going to charge the consumer an extra 15% or inflate the prices on the menus. And consumers are willing to pay that. And in the end, what happens is if a consumer comes to website one and they're, you know, they're looking for one, you know, restaurant A, and that restaurant's not there, and then they go to website or app two and they find it there and they're willing to pay that extra money, they just acquired that consumer. Mm-hmm. They can now market 300 restaurants to them instead of 30. And that's how they acquired and kept a lot of consumers.
Wow. And I think this translates to the story that if we look since 2014, since we've been in the industry, it was like DeliverLogic had kind of 4 years of consecutive growth. And that growth was because new clients were coming on to DeliverLogic, more independent food delivery companies were popping up and again, coming onto DeliverLogic software. And then the existing clients that are on DeliverLogic software were also growing in size. So all these were sort of growth drivers for DeliverLogic. And this is at a time when Grubhub and Uber Eats are also emerging into the market and putting increased competition in different markets. But it didn't seem like those really affected the business of DeliverLogic clients, but it was DoorDash that did. It seemed like when DoorDash came in, it was like, man, you hear about Uber Eats a lot. Like I was very familiar with Uber Eats and Grubhub, not so much with DoorDash. But then also when DoorDash came into markets, it seemed like all of a sudden they were, you know, no pun intended, but eating the lunch of our clients, right? But how is that narrative in your mind? Is it similar or was there other variables?
Yeah, I mean, it was, we had clients and when they had an Uber or a Grubhub come into their market, because Uber and Grubhub were they were on the commission side, right? They weren't on the just listing restaurants. So what would happen is they would dump money into signing up restaurants and educating restaurants. And when we started, the biggest challenge for most of our clients, a lot of it was just educating restaurants on what this is and how it works and how it can be incremental sales and drive consumers to your product. And that was a big hurdle for them. And then convincing them to give you 20 to 30%. Well, you have Uber and Grubhub come into the market and they start educating the restaurants too. It really didn't change much because the restaurants that were open to it were listed on all these sites now. And then restaurants that were brought into it by one of them, you could now close them as a client of ours. It was easier to close them because if you're doing it with one, right, there's no difference. If you're paying 30% for an order from Uber, then doing it from a DeliverLogic client, fine. It's the same thing, right? It's the same process. But then DoorDash would come into the market and they would just list every single restaurant and just blast a ton of marketing. And it really was a disruptor in those markets. I mean, it was really interesting to see what happened on a local level when a DoorDash came in because sales would drop from, I mean, it was crazy, 20 to 50% in those markets. So it was, it was real interesting. And then, of course, at the same time, you know, you mentioned earlier, bringing on more clients while volume was increasing. Then when DoorDash started to get into the market and really disrupt, now everyone started acquiring delivery services, right? Like Grubhub, for example, that's been a big thing for them. They acquire delivery services. Mm-hmm. Bite Squad acquired a ton of delivery services, and then they were acquired by Waiter. So at the same time, so we had seen all this growth of new clients coming on, building their business, current clients building their business, in this huge increase. Then DoorDash comes in, they start disrupting, everyone starts moving different, right? They got to do something different to keep their volume up. So clients start losing volume. At the same time, a bunch of our clients got acquired. And of course, when a company is looking to acquire, they're not acquiring the new guys that are doing, you know, a couple thousand orders. They're acquiring your largest clients. So it was an interesting, I'd say like probably 2 years of DoorDash coming in and disrupting, and then companies like, Bite Squad acquiring clients, and it definitely had a huge impact on our business and our network.
And everyone was talking about industry consolidation, and that was kind of the story of 2018, 2019, even. And then COVID hit, right? And then another systemic change. So what have you guys seen and experienced during COVID, both in terms of company growth and any types of new trends that you've seen?
I mean, there's obviously just a ton of growth with COVID. And what happened with COVID was, I always said it would take about, in 2018, 2019, I was saying it'll take about 10 years to get to where the delivery service industry is, you know, kind of getting to its full potential. And COVID just said, no, that's we're going to do that in like 6 months. And it took 10 years and shrunk it down to 6 months, because now restaurants that would never deliver, where you're thinking, you know, like look at like a Ruth Chris Steakhouse or something, where it's like, look, there's no reason to deliver a steak, because it's just not going to be what it's going to be when it leaves the restaurant until it gets there. The temperature is going to change. Everything's going to change. And those restaurants that were focused on in-restaurant dining now had to also jump into delivery. And really, at this point, it's hard to find a restaurant that doesn't offer delivery through a partnership. So that really, really changed things in just getting everyone on board with it.
And have you seen an uptick in, so this whole thing kind of 2018, 2019 with consolidation, I guess even the years before that, 2017, massive industry consolidation, who would want to open an independent food delivery business, because you're going to have to compete with DoorDash, Uber Eats, Grubhub, you're going to have to compete with all these. Now there's also a lot of acquisitions happening in the time of the independent. So I'm sure some people were thinking might be a good time to get in, try to grow business quick and sell it. But really, from the outside view, it's like, who wants to get in and compete with these behemoths? So now, have you guys seen any type of increase in, you know, in entrepreneurs starting up independent food businesses? Because obviously the whole industry's got a shot of adrenaline. Or is it more just that the existing independent clients are growing their businesses now?
I mean, we're seeing another resurgence of new clients. It's real interesting, because something else that kind of came along with COVID was a whole local support vibe, right? And people have been very outspoken about providing support to local business owners. So of course you're going to have people who they like the large, you know, Uber Eats or DoorDash, but then you have a huge crowd that not only really likes to support local, but also likes the fact that there's some local support there. So, I mean, everyone knows if you've ordered with a Grubhub, DoorDash, or Uber, and there's an issue, most of it's like, you know, if they forgot something, yeah, we're just going to take that off your bill. Well, a lot of times people are like, well, I want that, right? So, and someone's not eating now, where most of our network, because they're smaller, they're a little more agile with things, and they have U.S. customer service reps. They can, you know, they'll get the food back out there on the fly to the customer and still do something for them on the financial side. So I think there's been a handful of things that have really given opportunity for small business owners to start and use our software to get the business going, and then for our clients to also grow from, you know, the hits they've taken back up to new levels. So, and then of course we have some new relationships with huge third parties like Google, for example, that have given a lot more opportunity.
Got it. Well, as we transition into DoorDash IPO specifics, I just want to make sure I understand DoorDash's go-to-market strategy with getting into new markets, because they did it so quick. But basically all they needed to do, or all they have done, is when they're going into a new market, they're just finding every restaurant that's in that market, basically listing them. And then all they need is really to go get the drivers, right? Because they're pumping marketing into that. So they're acquiring the customer, getting the orders. And then all they need to do is execute the orders, which basically just have someone call, make, you know, or put in that order and then go pick it up and deliver it to the customer. Is that as simple as, as it has been for DoorDash?
I mean, I would say now it's much simpler because they're probably just have partnerships ready to go because restaurants are just hopping on. So although when they started and that was their, that was their process. Now I'm sure they're just going in and partnering up with just about everyone in the market, but still listing those who they're not with. I think also having national partners probably is a huge catalyst as well, right? So when they go into an area, if you have a partnership with, let's say you brought up McDonald's earlier, anywhere you go, you have that partnership with McDonald's at all their locations. So I think they're probably more now going into markets with 80% partners and 20% non-partners. So,
cool. Well, let's transition into the much anticipated IPO coming up in about 3 days from now. Mike, I was trying to understand exactly what it's like to IPO and how to even acquire the shares of an IPO. I've never bought shares of an IPO like before the IPO or I guess on the day of trading. But could you explain a little bit of what that process actually looks like?
Sure. So, I mean, you know, there are two different things there, Sam. I mean, one is being able to acquire shares pre-IPO. One is being able to acquire shares technically in the IPO. And then there's, acquisition of shares post-IPO, which is what most people will participate in here. Acquiring shares on the IPO are a little bit difficult. And I think here technically for DoorDash, the IPO date is set for the 8th, as you mentioned, but it won't actually trade on the New York Stock Exchange until the following day on December 9th. So most people that want to buy DoorDash shares will likely be looking to December 9th as the critical date to get a hold of those shares. Because typically what happens in an IPO is that the large underwriting banks, and in this case, you have Goldman Sachs leading the underwriting, and it's co-led by JP Morgan. It's their largest, most profitable clients that are going to get the allocation of shares. So what happens, and one of the main responsibilities of Goldman and JP Morgan is to basically help DoorDash place its shares with large institutions. These are the big buyers out there, the Fidelities of the world, the Vanguards, T. Rowe Price, large hedge funds, things of that nature, those institutional buyers. Goldman and JP Morgan and a few of the other banks that are helping place the shares are going to go out to those large clients. And, you know, they're going to try and get allocations into their hands on the date of IPO. And so that's really where you have to be in terms of trying to get the shares at the IPO price, which from what the scuttlebutt out in the market today is that the shares are going to price somewhere between 90 and 95 bucks a share. So that's hopefully that answers that question, at least from an IPO perspective. For most of the rest of us, sort of the retail buyer, is going to be looking to try and get shares on the 9th when they start trading. Just as a recent example, for example, we had back in September a company called Snowflake IPO'd. It was a highly anticipated IPO this year. They priced the IPO at 120 bucks a share. And the first trade that occurred on the exchange was at over 240 a share. It actually had doubled. So this is, that's what can happen in terms of the difference between the large institutional, big profitable clients for the banks that get allocated shares at the IPO price. In Snowflake's case, 120. In DoorDash's case, somewhere between 90 and 95. If it is very hotly anticipated and there's a lot of demand from retail buyers on the first day of trading, the shares can trade up very significantly in the first trade. And, in other IPOs, they're not as hotly anticipated. The banks don't do as great of a job of, getting the shares allocated the way they need to, and the price can drop on the first day of trading in the market. But those are sort of the dynamics that are out there.
So as a retail purchaser, if let's just say I like that price, $95, and I want to buy the shares that first day, logistically, what does that actually look like? Am I buying the shares from DoorDash? If I put in, say, a buy order now, am I buying those shares from DoorDash, or is it more likely I'm buying those shares from one of the Goldman, or I forget who the other underwriter was, but one of their clients who was pre-allocated some shareholding?
Yeah, typically, it's a good question. You're typically going to be buying shares from the other holders. You're not going to get the primary share issuance from the company. That is happening at the IPO with those large institutional buyers. And some of these buyers, remember, are already holders of the company. They're already invested in the private stage. So Fidelity, for example, is a DoorDash investor today. You know, they will likely increase their position on the IPO, so they would get new shares allocated to them. Now they may or may not sell in the IPO, or at least on the first day of trading, but it would be an owner like that where you're acquiring your shares from. Some other client that already owns the shares, either pre-IPO or they got an allocation on the IPO, that wants to just flip out of the shares on the first day. So, you know, and that's effectively what happened in the Snowflake IPO is, you know, some of these, like a hedge fund that is a big client of the bank that thinks that the stock is going to trade up on the first day, and he puts in for an allocation. And of course, you know, the bank wants to keep him happy and give him his allocation of IPO shares. He'll buy those shares of, you know, DoorDash in this case at between 90 and 95 bucks, and will immediately look to potentially just sell the shares the following day when they start trading. If they think they can make, you know, 30, 40 in Snowflake's case, 100% on the first trade. So it's sort of a nice little tip for those big profitable clients to get that allocation. And some of them will sell their shares if there's enough demand on the first day and the price is high enough.
So those clients are actually purchasing the shares before the public retail offering. So they're actually paying I'm assuming they're getting some type of potential discount on the shares. Like if DoorDash is anticipating $90 to $95 a share, are these Goldman clients getting them at 75 or 80, or do we just not know?
No, they're getting them at the IPO price. They just have the benefit of actually acquiring the shares at the IPO price and not at the secondary, because as soon as it starts trading on the NYSE, those are secondary market trades. They are not sales from the company directly to the market. They are sales from an owner of the shares to another potential owner of the shares. So that that is kind of the benefit there for those owners, is they have, you know, or those IPO, those folks that are getting the IPO allocation, they're able to acquire it at the IPO price, and then they're able to sell it, you know, to other buyers at a potentially higher price. Interestingly, DoorDash actually raised private money earlier this year, in the middle of the pandemic. I mean, they raised, you know, another private round back in June. They raised money at a valuation of about $16 billion. And it's interesting because this IPO allocation, and this IPO that for the company, if they price between 90 and 95 bucks, it's valuing the company at over $30 billion. So that means that the value of the company has nearly doubled just in the last 5-6 months, at least based on the valuation that they just recently raised capital at and what the IPO is suggesting.
Yeah, another happy beneficiary of COVID. So,
correct.
Food delivery has certainly been one of the winners. Well, it says, or I read that they're trying to sell 33 million shares, which, as you said, would imply an over $30 billion valuation, but that would also mean capital into the company of over $3 billion, which I guess is the primary reason a company does an IPO, is actually to continue to raise money. So of that 33 million shares, would they be trying to fully allocate those shares before the actual secondary market trading begins via Goldman's clients and other, you know, other large private investors?
Absolutely. And actually, one of the main responsibilities of the underwriter, you know, the Goldman's and the JP Morgan's and, you know, all the other banks that are on the cover of this IPO, is that they basically guarantee the fulfillment of that. So those 33 million shares are going to be purchased at the IPO. If Goldman can't place them all, and JP Morgan and all the other banks can't place them all, they're going to take Goldman and JP Morgan, they're going to pull the rest of those shares onto their books, onto their inventory until they can sell it. So they are, the part of what the underwriter does is guarantee the company that they will basically sell those shares or buy those shares. So the company doesn't bear that risk.
That's interesting. And then in the case of Snowflake, how does the actual price jump so much upon secondary trading? Is it the same? Is it just simply supply and demand? Like if everyone's trying to sell, let's say in Snowflake's case, is it the case that the original price was 100, the first trade was at 200? Does that mean that everyone that was buying effectively had a market order on, or, you know, a limit order, but those limit orders weren't, there wasn't any sellers that were willing to sell at a price less than 200?
Well, yeah, so it's a good question. So yeah, the shares were placed at 120 to the IPO buyers, the IPO, the folks to get the IPO allocation. And then what happens on the first day of trading, and you may, if you go back and look at Snowflake and for other companies too, particularly in ones that are, you know, really sort of hot IPOs, you know, the market may open at 9:30, but those shares may not trade until the afternoon. The first trade may not even occur until the afternoon. Mm-hmm. So it may be a few hours before you ever see a trade on an exchange. And the reason for that is because all the brokers and banks and, you know, all the firms out there that, you know, if you have an account at Fidelity or Ameritrade or E-Trade or wherever you are, Robinhood, and you're placing an order to get those shares, you're usually doing it before the open. But of course, once the market opens, you could be placing orders as well. But until the shares trade, what those brokerage firms and banks are doing is they're basically building the order book, you know, on both sides of the equation. They're looking at all the folks that have the IPO shares that want to sell, what prices they want to sell at, how much they're willing to sell at those prices. And they're doing the same thing on the buy side. You know, who has a, you know, in the case of Snowflake, who has a limit order at $120? Like, who's expecting to get it for the IPO price? But as they move through that order book, they're looking at the highest, you know, the folks that are willing to pay the most. And if the folks that are willing to pay the most are willing to pay $250 a share, those shares are going to get sold first, right? Mm-hmm. The seller, because you're going to meet at the highest price. And so, you know, any seller that's wanting to sell Snowflake shares is going to meet that highest buyer first. They're going to want to get the most for their sales as possible. So that's how it happens. And that's why it can take so long, because they're trying to aggregate all this stuff up and figure out, all right, who's in the queue, at what price are they in the queue, and how early were they in at that price? And until they get all that stuff sorted out, a trade can't even happen. So that's you know, and that'll be the same thing for DoorDash. You know, people will want to trade the shares. They'll want to buy them on the 9th, and not knowing as to where all the other buyers are putting in their orders. You know, if you think the stock is worth $150 and not 95 or 90, then on the 9th, you'll put in an order for 150 for however many shares you want. And, you know, if somebody's not bidding a higher price than you, then you're going to get your shares that day for 150 or better.
It's an interesting process. Very interesting process. I've never participated in an IPO, so I might have to do it just to say I did.
Test it out.
Just like this is the first S1 that I started to read. Actually, an S1 is sort of sounds like a complicated technical name, but really all it is just a business plan. And you go in there and there's all the marketing material, why they, you know, why they're successful, market share, all that stuff. So it's pretty interesting. I'm not gonna read the rest of it, but it was cool to kind of take a look. And I guess they're all public whenever a company files for an IPO. So
yeah, it is a requirement. It's the basic, you know, registration statement for the company to make its IPO. And you're right. It's, you know, it's effectively a prospectus and a, you know, plan of their business and kind of review, a review of everything that they do and, you know, what expectations are and what the risks are, et cetera. So
even prospectus is kind of a complicated term. I'll just call it a business plan for us laymen out there, but I'm going to read off just a few stats about the DoorDash upcoming IPO and about the business. And then I want to get your guys' opinion on, are we buying this thing? Right. So first off, 2014, DoorDash was just a pretty small company, just 10 employees working out of a converted house. Flash forward to where we're at today. As we've been talking about, especially with Mike, looks like they're aiming for a $30+ billion IPO. They're about to sell off 10% of the company to raise more than $3 billion in new capital. They also have 5 million users on a $10 a month subscription free, and that subscription gives, I guess they call them Dashers or whatever their members are, free delivery. So every time that they order, there's no delivery fee. They just pay the food price. So that's a $50 million monthly reoccurring revenue stream that costs them nothing. It doesn't, they have no operational cost included in that. That's pretty sick. Last I read, they were trying to sell the shares between 75 and 85. So that price range keeps creeping up where it's now close to $100, looks like on the initial offering. What market share does DoorDash have? 49% of food deliveries in the U.S. That is a lot, to say the least. And that is up considerably over the last 2 years. In 2018, they had just under 20%, somewhere around 17%. Interesting, Uber Eats during that same time period has stayed relatively the same at about 26%. So 2018 to 2020, they've basically maintained a 26% market share. But DoorDash obviously dashing quite well right now. Compared to Grubhub, I found this pretty interesting. Just looking, you know, this sort of a flashback towards our episode of Ford versus Tesla, where you kind of have this shining tech star. But fundamentally, all the numbers were not even comparable to Ford at the time. And so it's interesting to make these kind of enterprise value comparisons. But Grubhub at a glance, so both companies are generating roughly the same revenue, right around $2 to $2.5 billion a year. Now, Grubhub is almost break even. Their net profit margin is minus 2%. So on that, say $2 billion a year, they are losing around $40 million. So about negative 2%. Now DoorDash is losing a lot more. Their net profit is a loss of 10% right now. They're losing about $150 million on that, just under $2 billion in revenue. So interesting there. Obviously, Grubhub's numbers at a glance looking better, although both companies are losing money. Now, DoorDash IPO, if they hit the numbers that they're projecting, their market cap will be 5 times that of Grubhub. 5 times. Grubhub's market cap's only around $6 billion right now, and that is up significantly in COVID. I think it's up about 50% since the bottom of COVID. So their stock has gone through quite an implosion since 2018, much thanks probably to DoorDash, actually. But if you look at a stock chart, they topped out in 2018, have dropped, I think, about 150% since that time. So take a look at that. But very interesting comparison. Joe, I don't know if you have any more perspectives as we start to wrap up this episode on kind of DoorDash versus Grubhub, and if you have a preference to the business models of either of those, because I think they vary slightly. Grubhub's market share on food deliveries is only 20% compared to DoorDash's 49%. But yet they report about the same amount of revenues. So Grubhub must be making money in other avenues than DoorDash.
Yeah, I mean, Grubhub's always been focused on the restaurant relationship a little more than actually a lot more than DoorDash. So of course, you know, as I mentioned earlier, Grubhub, they started off as just a marketing portal, and then they acquired a couple large delivery services in 2015. Then another one. So, you know, they went over and acquired Restaurants on the Run, Dining In, Deliver Dish, and LA Bite. And then they've been big in strategic partnerships. So Yelp acquired Eat24, which was another listing, restaurant listing site. And then Grubhub, in a strategic partnership with Yelp, acquired Eat24 from Yelp. So it's real interesting that you'll see, if you're on Yelp as a consumer and you go to get delivery, it actually takes you straight to Grubhub. So I think, you know, what Grubhub's really done is they've focused more on commission-based deliveries and strategic partnerships and acquisitions to help keep their margins better, where, you know, DoorDash has just been all about raising funds and listing as many restaurants as possible and acquiring consumers and driving their sales that way. So they're definitely two very different business models. And of course, I think it'll be interesting once there's a more open look into DoorDash's books and how they're operating on who will end up to be more successful. But I think there's going to be space for tons of competitors in this market, and it's just going to keep growing.
To your comment, looks like DoorDash has raised $2.5 billion to date. But their last post-money valuation, as Mike said, was $16 billion. So if they achieve a $30-plus billion valuation at this IPO off of $2.5 billion raised and deployed, pretty good return on deployed capital. And I'm sure all the early investors will be quite happy with that. Mike, how do you feel about DoorDash's IPO? Is it anything that excites you, and are you a buyer?
I think it's going to be a successful IPO. I think people are, you know, in an environment where growth is more challenging to come by, this company is certainly growing tremendously, obviously, even, and part of this pandemic driven, but you know, that has just sort of accelerated a trend that was already in place. And I think part of the reason why you'll have some pretty significant demand here is because people will expect this to continue. You know, so I think that, you know, even just in the short term, and this is more of a technical feature, but that because it's a hotly anticipated IPO, you know, you're going to have some pretty significant demand here for the shares in the short term, which should make it a successful IPO and lead to a higher price. I mean, you're sort of seeing just over the last year, I mean, they did nearly $900 million in revenue in 2019. I mean, that could go over $3 billion this year. In 2020, yeah, they had done nearly $2 billion just through the first three quarters. And the fourth quarter tends to be a big quarter. And so if they keep the same growth pace up, they're going to get to near that $3 billion mark. And I would just say that, you know, if you kind of look at the way the IPO is being priced, and you look at the peer set out there for other delivery and logistics types of companies like this, they tend to trade at a multiple of revenue. And, you know, in the U.S., it's kind of, you know, between 7 and 9 times the revenue range. But if you look at like Meituan, which is the big delivery service in China, they trade at over 13 times. Now, they obviously have a bigger market to tackle there. But for the leader in the space in the U.S. that's growing tremendously, you know, to be priced at approximately 10 times, if they can keep the pace of growth up. And, you know, last year with the, you know, the amount of revenue they did, they're only, I think, under 3% of food and beverage that is consumed off premises. So there's a lot of market share here left, and that's just in food and beverage. So, you know, which is where they're focused right now. There's a lot of other things they could be delivering, and they've built a tremendous network, which this is where they're starting to monetize it. So, you know, as they continue to grow, you know, margins should improve here pretty dramatically. Gross margin has already increased 13% over the last year. Maybe even stronger once we get through the fourth quarter. I think third quarter gross margin this year was 57%. It was 40% last year. So that's a pretty big increase there. And of course, they're driving those efficiencies down onto the operating side too. Sales and marketing expenses have declined from 70% of revenue to 30% of revenue. R&D spend has gone from 14 to 4%. So they're starting to, you know, you're going to sort of see them turn the corner on operating income pretty quickly if the growth continues at the pace that it's going. And there's a lot of room for growth.
Love it. Good analysis. Joe, as an operator on the ground and just seeing all the different trends and players in the industry and including new entrants, does this excite you, or is there other companies that you think are moving quicker or have more potential?
No, I mean, I think it's pretty exciting. It'll be interesting to see what happens short term and long term. You know, I think as Mike said, you have a lot of different products that they can deliver that the, you know, the House just pushed to approve cannabis to be legal on a federal level. And then you're also on the adverse side, you're going to see, I think the first COVID vaccine was approved. And I forget what country approved it, but I think something got approved just today or yesterday. And then the FDA is supposed to move to approve in the U.S. So once consumers really start getting back into restaurants, it's going to be interesting to see what restaurants do on the delivery side. Are they going to try to pull that back and minimize the amount of orders they allow to go out the door at a big commission if they have a bunch of consumers dining in the restaurant? So it'll be interesting, but I think in the short term, it'll definitely be exciting, and it'll be interesting to see what the price does. So yeah, I'm excited about it for the short term for sure.
And then slightly related, but Uber just acquired Postmates, and Postmates, I guess for everyone who doesn't know, is also a pretty big player in the industry, and they're actually covered in DoorDash's S1. So that's a pretty big consolidation right there between those two big ones.
Yeah, I would also say that Google is starting to enter the space now, and it will be very interesting to see what they do, of course, because they're very powerful. So
cool.
That'll be interesting.
Good. Very exciting industry to be part of. Joe, good luck with Deliver Logic. Mike and both of you, thanks for coming on and the commentary and the analysis on the DoorDash IPO. I will let everyone know what I'm doing on Tuesday or Wednesday because I haven't made up my mind yet. But I think it would be interesting to be part of the IPO process, even if you're just one of the first buyers on the retail side. So consideration there. Guys, have a great weekend and thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks for having us.
Thanks a lot, Sam. Have a good one.
Dashing, Derek. That was just dashing. Dashing through the snow. It is the holiday season. So hopefully we're dashing towards some profits. What do you think of this investment?
DoorDash is dashing to. So since Derek and I have recorded the intro, I actually started getting a barrage of text messages from Mike and Joe, who we just had on the this episode, who we just heard from. So DoorDash is about to open for trading, and when we recorded this episode, they were talking about a $75 to $85 price target, which basically a day later was at $100. Now, and that would have already been surpassing a $30 billion valuation. When we were recording the intro, I get the texts to say the price targets for trading later today is now 170 to 175. Then 2 minutes later, it's now 195. So this is reminiscent to Snowflake, what we were talking about on the episode where price was 100 and it opened at 200. Now we're talking a $65 billion valuation.
That's insane. Even just an hour ago, I saw like 140 to 150, and now we're up to 200, you're saying?
Crazy. This is actually really cool because this is exactly like the kind of questions we're trying to understand on the episode. And now it's like playing out on my phone right now. So I put in yesterday a buy order at a price target of 100.
I did 110.
Limit order. 110,
I don't think either of these are going to happen.
I'm like, I'm not going to 102, but I'll do 100.
I did my 10% above approach, which was 10% above at the time. Now it's 90% below the asking price. So we'll see how that turns out. I'm a little skeptical because after last week's Airbnb talk, I'm really confident in Airbnb's ability to grow, and I love their business model. I don't love DoorDash at twice the price of Airbnb valuation.
I have to agree. I was saying, even if these companies were equally valued, just from my understanding in the industry, I would say I like Airbnb better. And especially now at this price target, there's big international companies in this space, and you got to think, okay, this is a $70 billion company. Look at market cap. If you're a $1 trillion company, you're one of, say, the five most biggest companies in the world.
Sure.
And we're talking only a year ago, no companies were $1 trillion, right? Now, all of a sudden, there's five or six. Tesla's on the way to be there. But this is what originally drew me to Tesla stock. Tesla's market cap, when I got into it, was around $15 billion. And Elon Musk is saying he thinks that Tesla will be the first $1 trillion company. And if we go back to episode 65, we're saying, well, okay, well, what if Elon's only half right? I mean, Elon's a pretty credible person, right? Sure. He's done some amazing things.
He's also a marketing genius.
Yeah, he's got this grand vision. And if he's only half right, if it gets to $500 billion, well, that's still, that's still a 50 bagger from $15 billion. So, and if he gets to $100 billion, it's just crazy the types of returns. And that's basically what's happening right now with Tesla. It's almost a $700 billion market cap. It's gone up from like $100 billion to $700 billion just this year, and it's on its way to becoming $1 trillion company. To the profit of Mr. Elon Musk. But
I think something like that looks more positive than a DoorDash. First of all, Tesla's sexy. Yeah. It's something cool that you want to talk about. It's not super cool to talk about food delivery. No offense. I know you're invested in it, but it's not the hot topic of the table. And at the time when Tesla was IPOing, they had no real competitors. It was all the right. Auto manufacturers were still stuck to gas, maybe a couple of hybrids, nothing focused on EVs. Now they're starting to catch up a little bit. But at the time, Tesla was in its own world, and there was nothing that even compared to what they were putting out. And you can't say the same thing about DoorDash. They have real competitors.
Absolutely. Think of Tesla. This was always my argument for Tesla, is think of the infrastructure they have. Think of the assets they have. They have the nationwide charging system and infrastructure. They have these 5 gigafactories, which are basically the 5 biggest factories in the world, right? They have all this battery technology, IPs, et cetera, right? They're bringing in SolarCity now. Like, it's going to be the world's biggest renewable energy company. What's DoorDash have? They have an app and they have a fleet of drivers. They literally have no assets. We're talking a $70 billion market cap. How high can it go? Can that go? Well, in today's world, I guess you can't really assume how high it's going to go. But really, to think this company goes up 3 or 4 times from here, that's a tough ask. So, but I do think Airbnb is truly disruptive. They got the world's largest inventory now. There's just some great things there, but I think this has been interesting. I mean, I'm not a buyer at this price range, Derek. How about you?
I got to stay away too. I'm interested to see what Airbnb does tomorrow, obviously. DoorDash, and like we said last week too, these IPOs go up and down like a roller coaster the first few months too. So I think it's worth keeping an eye on and seeing what happens. Like Mike and Joe said, it's a growth industry. It's just COVID really set off the growth. And basically what they said, we've gotten about 4 years growth in 6 months, 6 months time, which is great. But what happens when all these restaurants open back up and people can actually go inside? Are you still going to want that cold steak on your couch, or are you going to want to go back in and have that real experience in a restaurant?
I don't know, Derek. I kind of hate humans at this point. I'd rather just stay at home and order my food in either way.
Maybe this is really the new normal. You know, we just stay away from everybody, eat subpar food at home, and binge on Netflix.
Oh, man. I think I'll be wearing a mask out even 5 years after COVID. I just don't want to talk face-to-face with somebody and have them spit on me as they talk.
It has made everyone, I think, a lot more self-aware of how gross humans really are.
Yeah. Well, quick cautionary tale for all the listeners out there. When you are buying stocks like this with limited liquidity, you got to use limit orders. So I bought this company called Waiter, which is a food delivery business. So this company, Waiter, acquired a company called Bite Squad. Bite Squad was taking up, buying up and acquiring a lot of DeliverLogic's clients. And their idea was roll up as many as they can, pay a little bit upfront, and offer them, you know, a lot of earnings when they go public. And so they rolled up a bunch of our clients, took them off of DeliverLogic software. It was bad for DeliverLogic's business. And then they ended up selling for like $400 million to Waiter. Waiter is a publicly traded company. Waiter's stock tanked as DoorDash and Uber Eats kind of came into the market. No one thought that they could compete. Stock dropped under a dollar. And we knew the CEO that was going in and replacing the current CEO. And we thought he was a pretty sharp guy. And we're like, you know, let's take a punt on it. We'll buy it at a dollar. Well, like an idiot, I just placed a market order at that time, and the order went through, and I didn't check the actual statement to see what price I got it on. Right, I just said I want, you know, 10,000 shares, etc. Well, the other day I look and the stock is up to like $4. I'm like, hell yeah! Like I just made 4x of my money. Right, this is amazing. We nailed it. We got it right. And I looked and the order went in at $2.10 instead of like 90 cents because I put a market order instead of a limit order. And so I still did
a nice profit,
still got 2X on it, but I should have had 4X if I just used a limit order. And this is point in case with DoorDash, you could easily put a market order in and you think you're going to get it at 100 or the IPO price. And in fact, you might end up, the way things are going right now, you might end up getting it at like 250 or something. So
it's going to be a lot more than you bargained for. Sam, we always love to hear your disaster stories so we can learn from them.
How else you learned, Eric?
Exactly.
Doing everything correctly?
Well, while we're on the case of market basics, I saw a really funny story this morning.
Market basics.
DoorDash's ticker symbol is Dash, D-A-S-H, but there's a theory right now that the stock Door, that's D-O-O-R, it's up over 4% this morning. It's actually a door company, but the theory is that a lot of people think this is DoorDash's stock. So
I feel like this happens all the time.
There's a lot of inexperienced people in the market, which can be, you know, hopefully we're on the opposite end of that and we can take advantage of these people that don't know what they're doing.
Yeah. So what should we do? A short Door?
I think possibly, yeah. The play tomorrow might be the short Door stock. Sorry, Door. Masonite, I should say.
Good. Interesting stuff. Good for these companies. I know the DoorDash CEO is about to become a billionaire in a few hours. And I think I don't know too much about the guy, but he's got, you know, his family was, his parents were first generation immigrants to the US. Kind of reminds me a little bit of Johnny, actually. I think he's like a Taiwanese guy. Parents are first generation immigrants to the US and kind of, you know, had to hustle on the way up. So without knowing him or knowing he's a good guy, I would say congratulations. You built a huge company in pretty, you know, 6 years. That's pretty fast for a startup to achieve that scale. So hats off to them. They had a really good go-to-market strategy, thought outside the box, found a way to acquire inventory that seems simple now, but back in the day, it was, it was a gamble. It was risky and it took a lot of persistence and they got it done and making a lot of people wealthy today. So congrats. And for all the listeners out there, let us know what you're doing. Are you buying DoorDash? Are you buying Airbnb? Got some threads going on in the Boss Lounge. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, we're definitely going to post that in the Boss Lounge. I'm also going to, I'll post in Patreon my experience if any of these shares get picked up, how that goes. I'm hoping for a nice Airbnb win tomorrow. We'll find out. DoorDash, I'm staying away. If we're at 200, I'm staying away. I think it sounds like you are too, Sam.
I am. Derek, always good to hear your hustle stories. It seems like every time that we talk, I'm revealing a new investment mistake and you're revealing a new side hustle that we had no idea that you were making an extra $500 a month doing. So that's pretty cool.
More to come, which I'm sure we got some more of your stories to come as well. So looking forward to it.
All right, guys. Everyone enjoy the remaining weeks of December. We've almost made it through 2020, and everyone should go out and buy themselves a I Survived 2020 shirt. That's a badge of honor after this wreck of a year. But happy holidays to everyone, but we'll be talking to you probably before then.
For sure. Q4 final year-end update coming with Sam and Johnny soon. Remember, you got to be a Patreon member to get the full video. Sam reveals a ton of his portfolio that he normally would not, so you definitely got to check it out. Johnny, I think, is closing in on the $1 million mark, so lots of cool stuff in there. patreon.com/investlikeaboss, or just go to investlikeaboss.com, find out how to sign up. You can get in as low as $5 a month, and I think the value you find in there is gonna more than pay off that amount.
Investing is easy, just Bitcoin and Tesla, that's all you got to do. Retire early, baby.
Make sure to add a few other things in your basket too. But Sam, I think Elon needs to start paying you for the hype machine you are.
Oh man, I was giving him some love on Instagram the other day, just, you know, telling him good job. And I found out that I was following the wrong Elon account. It was just some like,
oh no,
fan page. What, I feel like an idiot.
Okay, and this, don't so. And don't buy stock in Door either, Sam.
I'm passing on Door, and I'm passing on Dashing. But, if I'm ever in, where are you located? LA, right?
Yeah.
I'm ever located in LA and I order on DoorDash, I'll be sure to put up a big tip. Maybe I'll just have Derek deliver it.
Sounds good. I'll be first in line. As long as you tip, make sure to tip people.
Make sure to tip people. Tip well. Sayonara, people. Until then.
Thanks, guys. See you later.
Thanks for listening to the Invest Like a Boss podcast. Join our mailing list at investlikeaboss.com to get exclusive access to our insider investment portfolios and our private members forum.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends and leave us a review in the iTunes store. It helps more than you know. See you guys next week.